KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. South Dakota Republican Senator Mike Rounds has requested the issue of violent crime be addressed on the nation's reservations. In a letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi and Secretary of Interior Doug Burgum, the senator has requested the creation of the Violent Crime Reduction Commission, specifically for tribal lands. This comes after several tribes address concerns about violent crime conditions. Rounds describes the situation on Great Plains Reservation communities as, quote, a public safety crisis. Historically, reservations have seen higher than average rates of violent crime than the larger U.S., while contending with understaffing of law enforcement services. A report that highlighted the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous people was removed from several federal websites last month, to the disappointment of some Alaska Native advocates. The final report by the Not Invisible Act Commission was a joint effort by the U.S. Justice and Interior Departments completed in 2023. It focused on the disproportionate rates of assault and murder in Indigenous communities across the country, as well as unique issues faced by Alaska Native people. President Trump signed the law that mandated the report during his first term. In February, the report's authors and advocates noticed that the link had been deleted from several federal websites, including the Department of Justice. The reason for the removal was not immediately clear. Michelle Demmer is a longtime tribal judge and University of Alaska Fairbanks professor who is one of the report's commissioners. Demmer, who's Tlingit and Haida, says she was deeply disappointed with its removal.
It's like a slap in the face. It just really saddens me then to have the report removed like it doesn't even exist.
For 18 months, the commission heard from people across the country, including in Anchorage, Bethel, and Emonic. Those stories were included in the final report.
People traveled far and wide to come give testimony about situations that involved their loved ones. They trusted us with their stories, even though it was painful for them to have to retell these stories, but they felt like this might be the one opportunity that someone hears them and takes action.
Charlene Akpik-Apak is the executive director of the nonprofit Data for Indigenous Justice. Apak, who's Anupiak, attended the commission hearing that was held in Anchorage. She found it unsettling that the report was deleted from websites, but she does not want people to be discouraged.
We still know what was said. We still know our truth. We still know our stories, and they can't take that away from us. Our knowledge and our truth is something that cannot be erased.
Apak says she appreciates the report's specific recommendations for Alaska, which spoke to historic violence against Alaska Native women, the landscape and structure of rural communities, and challenges with legal and public safety systems. She adds that despite the report's removal, organizations like Data for Indigenous Justice will continue to document and track cases of violence against Indigenous people in Alaska. The Center for Native American Youth has announced its cohort for this year's Remembering Our Sisters Fellowship. The virtual storytelling and digital arts program supports Native youth who are raising awareness about missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit. During the six-month program, fellows will create digital art and storytelling projects to bring attention to the issue. Six fellows from tribes across the country, including from Oklahoma, Arizona, and California, were chosen for the program. Fellows will receive technical assistance, mentorship, and opportunities to share their projects. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Unfair competition from low-cost producers who aren't held to appropriate labour and environmental standards. In the seafood space, the worst offender is Russia.
Alaska seafood processors warn that President Trump's trade policies could hurt the industry. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 25th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, scientists work to understand how rapidly melting glaciers impact the environment around them.
We know that glaciers are changing. We know that the ocean is changing. But how those two impact each other is kind of the edge of the field.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
The Alaska seafood industry says it's getting crushed by unfair trade, and tariffs are part of the problem. Industry groups are urging the federal government to push back against international competition they say doesn't play by the rules. The Alaska Desk's Theo Greenlee reports.
Two major Alaska seafood trade groups are sounding the alarm. The At-Sea Processors Association and Pacific Seafood Processors Association earlier this month sent a letter to the Trump administration warning against hardline trade policies. They say new tariffs could trigger retaliation. The At-Sea Processors Association represents most of the vessels that catch and process pollock in the Bering Sea. CEO Matt Tinning says all of these disputes threaten Alaska seafood, which is already at a disadvantage.
We also face unfair competition in global markets. Unfair competition from low-cost producers who aren't held to appropriate labor and environmental standards. In the seafood space, the worst offender is Russia.
Russian seafood has flooded markets in recent years. And while the Biden administration closed a loophole that allowed Russian fish into the U.S. market, American producers are still struggling to compete overseas. Existing tariffs are part of that struggle. Alaska seafood was hit pretty hard during the 2018 trade war with China, which still has tariffs in place on U.S. seafood. And earlier this month, China announced an additional 10% tariff in response to the new tariffs Trump imposed days before. The European Union, one of Alaska's biggest export markets, also continues to impose tariffs from the last trade war, even as their own products enter the U.S. duty-free. In their letter, the two Alaska trade groups warn about further retaliation. Tinning says they aren't necessarily opposed to reciprocal tariffs, but the industry is particularly fragile, exporting about two-thirds of what it produces, so they're vulnerable to trade tensions.
And so we really do live and die by fair access to those export markets.
The trade groups also raised concerns about labeling rules in the European Union, where Russian-caught pollock is sometimes sold as Alaska pollock, even if it was caught and processed entirely outside the U.S. They say the combination of foreign tariffs, labeling confusion, and global overproduction could push the already struggling sector to the brink, especially if retaliatory tariffs from countries like China or Canada once again target U.S. seafood. In Unalaska, I'm Theo Greenlee.
A murder and subsequent wrongful conviction case in Fairbanks that sparked community backlash and grabbed national headlines is coming to an end. The final member of the Fairbanks Four has settled his wrongful conviction suit with the city of Fairbanks. KUAC's Patrick Gilchrist reports.
The agreement comes more than 7 years after the Fairbanks Four sued the city in federal court, claiming Fairbanks police had manufactured evidence to convict them for a murder they didn't commit. The city will pay Marvin Roberts $11.5 million, says Fairbanks city attorney Thomas Chard.
The city is going to make installment payments, kind of in a structured payment for that amount, and they're working on the finalizing the settlement agreement.
Chard advises city officials and oversees the third-party lawyer representing the city in the case. He says attorneys in the case recently reached a dollar figure through mediation.
It was a pretty intense negotiation, and it involved a very experienced mediator that helped parties come to that number.
The settlement means Roberts' claims against the city and four of its police officers won't go to a jury for trial, which was scheduled for December. Once all the terms are finalized, Chard says it will close out a lawsuit that's been ongoing since late 2017. That's when the four indigenous men, coined the Fairbanks Four, first filed the civil rights lawsuit. They were convicted for the 1997 murder of teenager John Hartman. The four were released in late 2015 after another man, William Holmes, confessed that he and a group of men had killed Hartman. Multiple witnesses corroborated that confession, and one, Arlo Olson, said Fairbanks Police Department officers had coerced him to give a false statement against the Fairbanks Four. Each of the four men spent at least 15 years in prison and maintained their innocence throughout. Roberts was imprisoned for nearly 18 years.
It's just happy to see Marvin finally get justice.
That's Roberts' lawyer, Mike Kramer.
That's all he's been asking for since, you know, he was first wrongfully arrested and accused back in 1997. It's been a long, hard journey for him, and I'm just very happy to have helped him, you know, get to this point in his life where he saw that the justice system can actually work.
Roberts couldn't be reached directly for comment, but he said through a press release from his lawyer's office that no amount of money can make up for his time in prison. He added, quote, "This settlement, however, gives me freedom with my life and, most importantly, more time with my daughter and my parents who supported me throughout this nightmare," end quote. The other three members of the Fairbanks Four, George Fries, Kevin Peace, and Eugene Vent, settled with the City of Fairbanks insurer in 2023. They agreed to drop their portion of the federal civil rights lawsuit for about $1.6 million apiece. Neither settlement required the city to admit fault or issue a formal apology. In Fairbanks, I'm Patrick Gilchrist.
A Fairbanks Republican lawmaker wants to put the governor's mansion on Airbnb. Representative Will Stapp filed a bill last week that would require the governor's office to offer the Juneau residents up for rent on a short-term basis while the legislature is not in session.
I always try to look for ways to make government more efficient. And when you see that you have facilities that are underutilized, you should try to maximize them so they at least cover their own operating expense, you know.
The state pays a full-time staff of four to run the more than 14,000-square-foot mansion, including a manager, a private chef, and two housekeepers. The three-story home with 26 rooms, 10 bathrooms, and 8 fireplaces was built in 1912 with a stipend of $40,000 from the federal government. Salaries and upkeep on the mansion currently cost about $800,000 a year, according to budget documents. Stapp says he'd like to defray that cost. He says it's a great place for any number of events, parties, weddings, even overnight stays for Instagram influencers.
I don't think a normal person would pay an exorbitant amount of money to stay at a normal hotel room, but they would actually if, you know, they could rent the governor's mansion, for example.
Dunleavy spent a total of roughly 2 weeks in Juneau during the first 2 months of the year, according to his public calendars. Even so, Stapp told the Juneau Empire he did not intend the bill as a swipe at the governor. The governor's office did not respond to emails seeking comment. Most bills, though, introduced in the legislature have little chance of passing, and this one is no different. Senate President Gary Stevens is not taking the new bill seriously.
Well, that's pretty silly, and I'm sorry to hear that happen. I mean, we have some serious things to accomplish here. I mean, silly things happen. I introduced a bill once to change the name of Fairbanks just for the fun of it.
Stevens, a Kodiak Republican, introduced a resolution in 2005 that aimed to change the name of the Golden Heart City to Barnett's Cache. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, cuts to federal grants and staff could reduce food security for Indigenous communities.
We lost our entire team of people that are working to get Native communities greenhouses.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Ready or not, University of Alaska Giving Day is here. Visit givingday.alaska.edu to support UAF, UAA, and UAS students and programs. Double or triple your gift, win exciting prizes, and make a difference through 1 p.m. on March 27th. More at givingday.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Foundation.
Two injured climbers were rescued Sunday from a site high up on the slope of a mountain in the eastern Alaska range south of Fort Greeley. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Alaska State Troopers say they got a call just before 11 a.m. Sunday from a wildlife trooper who said he'd gotten a 911 call from one of the climbers who said they needed help. According to a trooper dispatch, the climber said they sustained injuries after getting caught in an avalanche while ascending the 11,400-foot McGinnis Peak. Troopers contacted the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, which sent an Alaska Air National Guard HH-60 Pavehawk helicopter and an HC-130 fixed-wing aircraft. Spokesperson Dave Bedard said the helicopter crew located and extracted the climbers from a high elevation.
They were hoisted by a Pavehawk helicopter and transported for release to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. This was done at an elevation of 7,000 feet, which is pretty remarkable.
A trooper spokesperson said Monday that one of the climbers was unable to walk and the other suffered a severe laceration on his arm and broken ribs. Bedard said the two victims were stabilized by the two medics aboard the helicopter and taken directly to Fairbanks Memorial.
Both aircraft have pararescue men on board, and these are highly trained, highly skilled paramedics who are not only experts in medicine, they're experts in Arctic medicine.
The trooper spokesperson declined to identify the victims, but he said both were from Fairbanks. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Friday was the first ever World Day for Glaciers, meant to sound the alarm on the pace of global melting. These rivers of ice shape the land and lives of Alaskans. KTOO's Alex Solomon spoke with glaciologists who are trying to answer big questions that remain about their future.
The ice cracks, fizzles, drips, and calves. These are the sounds of Glacier Bay National Park in Alaska's southern region, where most of the state's glaciers are concentrated. Glaciers funnel cold freshwater into rivers, carry nutrients from the mountains to the sea, and reflect sunlight back to space. The scientists who study them are uncovering how these rapidly changing systems affect our world and how much more we need to know. Kaya Riverman is a Portland, Oregon-based glaciologist and associate director of the Juno Icefield Research Program. She studies what makes glaciers flow.
Often we have this sense that glaciers are this really static thing.
Before and after pictures show glaciers retreating, sure, but usually over long periods. It's much faster than that.
They're almost like living, breathing creatures that change a little bit every day.
They speed up in the heat of the day and slow down as they cool at night. Glaciers make up an area of land in Alaska nearly equal to the size of West Virginia, but we're losing them quickly. The state is warming two or three times faster than the global average, and glaciers here have shrunk more than anywhere else since the turn of the century. As the ice melts, the average global sea level rises, though this doesn't affect much of Southeast Alaska, where the land is rising faster than the sea as it sheds the weight of glaciers. Riverman says it's challenging to predict and quantify how much melting glaciers cause sea level rise.
So we know that glaciers are changing. We know that the ocean is changing. But how those two impact each other is kind of the edge of the field still. And that's a problem.
Because millions of people in low-lying coastal areas around the world will get hit hard. Alaska's glacial meltwater has already contributed significantly to sea level rise, and scientists predict that will continue. To understand what's happening under the ice, Riverman and her team ski out onto the Juneau ice field every summer and put out seismometers that measure vibrations. They strike the surface of the ice with a sledgehammer or shoot it with blank shotgun shells.
And we use those miniature earthquakes to study how thick the ice is and what materials sit underneath the ice.
Other scientists look at glacier mass, how much glacier there actually is. Louis Sass is part of the oldest study of glacier mass in North America as a glaciologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Alaska Science Center. It's called the Benchmark Glacier Project. It started tracking a few of Alaska's glaciers, Lemon Creek in Juneau, Wolverine on the Kenai, and Golconna in the Alaska Range, in the 1950s and 60s. Back then, Sass says, it wasn't clear whether Alaska's glaciers were retreating continuously or if they had just shrunk some after the Little Ice Age and then stabilized.
People didn't really know what was happening because people hadn't paid really close attention. There were just very few glaciers that had any sort of picture record or enough data.
These days, rapid melting has created a relatively new problem for people who live in the freezing water's path, glacial outburst floods. In Juneau, Suicide Basin is a pool contained in steep rock and dammed by Mendenhall Glacier. During the summer, the pool fills and puts pressure on the ice dam until it suddenly breaks and drains into Mendenhall Lake, which then floods parts of the neighborhood in the valley below. Jamie Pierce is a hydrologist at the U.S. Geological Survey who monitors Suicide Basin. One summer day in late June of 2018, when he was setting up some monitoring gear in the basin, he thought he was witnessing the dam break in real time. Bubbles started to rise up to the water's surface. It was noisy, crackling and popping.
And then all of a sudden, a massive iceberg started to overturn. And it kind of set off a chain reaction.
The glacier calved off a chunk of ice roughly 100 feet deep and 200 feet long. Pierce and his colleagues thought it was going to trigger the big release. It didn't, but it showed the huge scale of change the glacier is undergoing and meant that the ice dam went quite deep. Major questions remain about Alaska's glaciers. How long will they last? How big can glacial outburst floods get? And what will happen when the ice is gone? Researchers are chasing answers to help Alaskans navigate a rapidly changing relationship with ice. In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to healthcare in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov.
All right, gonna break in for just a moment, and we'll have the school board, the Aleutians Eastboro School District, their school board meeting in just a few moments. Please stay tuned. 8:30 or 6:30, we'll have live coverage.
Cuts to federal grants and staff by the Trump administration could make food security even tougher. As the Alaska Desk's Ilona Nyden reports, that includes communities from Cook Inlet to Northwest Alaska.
Spring is a busy time at Tayonic Grown, a community farm located on the west side of the Cook Inlet. Local students come to plant seeds, water them, and then harvest organic fruits and vegetables. This summer, the farm managers had even bigger plans. They wanted to set up a community food forest that would include indigenous plants and fruit trees. But the forest and many more of Tayonic Grown plans are now up in the air because of cuts to federal staff and funding. That's according to Lori Stewart, the executive director of Tayonic Tribal Conservation District that manages the farm.
The loss of those funds in the coming years is going to have a big impact on the growth that we were building.
In Alaska, nearly all produce is imported, which makes the food supply vulnerable, especially in rural areas. Some support to local producers comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The department is among many agencies that cut programs and staff in response to Trump's executive orders. In recent weeks, the agency reinstated some of its employees, but then put them on administrative leave. This is the case for Amanda Compton, who lives in Palmer and works in the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. The program helps landowners, in Alaska mainly tribes, sustainably manage their natural resources. They helped villages set up fish passages, reindeer farms, and community gardens. That is, until the layoffs and disruptions, Compton says.
We lost our entire team of people that are working to get native communities greenhouses. Our team that's getting the native entities fish passages. We lost our entire team that communicates between the engineers and tribal entities.
Tayonik, an off-road community of about 300 people, is located about 40 miles southwest of Anchorage as the crow flies. Produce needs to be flown in, and fruits and vegetables grown at the Tayonik farm give locals a rare chance to enjoy affordable fresh food. The USDA's Forest Service in December awarded $900,000 to the conservation district operating the farm. Stewart with the district says the grant was meant to grow their team and set up a community food forest. The forest would promote food sovereignty and traditional ecological knowledge, but the department terminated the award in an effort to comply with Trump's objectives.
There's a lot of caution going into the summer, so even if we were to find that no funding was impacted, right now we're making decisions as if it might be, and so therefore the season will be impacted.
Tayonik worked with tribal liaisons like Compton and her team who helped them navigate the grant opportunities. The conservation district staff also doesn't know if they will have engineers to assist them in building fish passages this summer. Meanwhile, about 500 miles northwest, around Nome, reindeer herders are asking similar questions. Nathan Baring works for the Reindeer Herding Association, and he says tribal liaisons used to help herders apply for grants and establish rotational grazing plans. The Trump administration also halted a USDA grant meant to support indigenous peoples' animal harvests and help communities expand their meat processing.
And having all of that kind of just thrown either into the air or outright eliminated just simply means that we start over in terms of shopping those projects around again, which then further delays what I would describe as Alaska's untapped potential in a pre-existing livestock industry that is both culturally tied and has incredible potential.
For herders like Bonnie Suanya Shiel, interruptions in federal programs mean that it's harder to find funds to build temporary housing for workers and corrals for holding animals. Despite the challenges, Shiel believes the herders will figure out a way to continue the practice, even if it means providing food for just their village instead of expanding their operations.
It's going to come back around. We're still here. We're still herding reindeer. We're still providing for communities.
While some of the USDA employees in Alaska were reinstated, many have not received an official notice to go back to work as of Tuesday. Several USDA grants remained frozen or terminated. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
Layoffs at the National Weather Service have touched communities throughout Alaska. In Bethel, it meant the termination, then tentative reinstatement of a social scientist position. As KYUK's Samantha Watson reports, the position would be a return to a time of community engagement on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, one lost due to cuts in the past.
When Amy Hendricks was hired by the National Weather Service in January, she came stocked with ideas for weather-themed movie nights and community temperature blanket-making workshops. And while cute and crafty, they were also ways to get at something bigger.
So I had this idea coming out here, reopening up the weather office. I told the guy that was training me that I wanted like couches and I wanted a nice seating area because I wanted people to come in and talk about the weather.
Her position as a social scientist stationed in Bethel was newly created. It was designed to learn from YK Delta communities about what weather information they use and how they're using it to help the National Weather Service create more specific and useful reports. And for Hendricks, after pursuing a PhD on climate variability on the YK Delta, it was kind of a dream job. She moved to Bethel with her husband, 3-month-old baby, and 2 dogs in tow. She said she was excited to call Bethel home, so they jumped all in.
And everyone was so sure that the National Weather Service was going to be safe because it does provide, you know, life-saving information for protection of life and property. And so nobody expected the Weather Service to get hit as hard.
Weeks later, at the end of February, Hendricks received a letter announcing she'd been laid off.
It was like living in a sea of unknown, living in the dark for weeks. And so when it did come, it was like, oh, okay, like now I know for sure this is a certain thing in my life.
As of March 19th, 23 National Weather Service employees in Alaska have been laid off across departments, according to reporting from Alaska Public Media. Like Hendricks, some terminated probationary workers have been reinstated and put on administrative leave, though that number is not currently known. That's following a March 13th federal court decision, which found the firings had been carried out unlawfully. The reinstatement is temporary, and one the Trump administration says it aims to see through to elimination. Hendricks says she isn't hopeful the temporary reinstatement will mean she'll eventually get to go back to work. It's left her and her family in a kind of limbo and looking for more secure options.
Both my husband and I are working on finding jobs. We're just applying to some positions that we see in Bethel. We're happy to do anything. Pretty diverse skill sets. I think the biggest thing right now is just getting my 4-month-old baby on some health insurance.
On administrative leave, Hendricks can't.
Call the meeting to order. It's 6:31 p.m. Everybody stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag, the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. You know, great care for AC mine last night. Roll call, please.
Amy, she'll be in later.
Yes.
Brenda?
Yes.
Hillary?
Here.
Carla?
Here.
Rita?
Here.
Rhea?
Here.
Carlene?
Here.
And Morgan is not here. We have a quorum.
Others in attendance, King Cole? Karen Keck and Holly Stiles. Online,
we have KSDP, David Nielsen, Megan Gatlin, Austin Root, Matt Brown. I believe that's everybody. Oh, Mike Franklin.
Here, yeah, sure. Yes. Approval of agenda. I'll make a motion to approve the agenda as presented.
I'll second.
Roll call.
Carlene?
Yes.
Rhea?
Yes.
Rita?
Yes.
Brenda?
Yes.
Hillary?
Yes.
Carla?
Yes.
Motion carries.
Any public comments on agenda items? Yeah.
Go ahead. Speak if I have the opportunity. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
All right. My name is Holly Stiles, and I just wanted to take a moment and thank the board for 3 wonderful years with your children. I received a letter of from Mike last week saying that they've gone in a different direction. And so I just wanted to take the time and express how important King Cove has become to my family, and just wanted to be here to say thank you. And that's all I was showing up for today. I know that I'm on the list for under teacher contracts, and so I hope that I spoke in the appropriate place. Thanks.
Thank you, Holly. Are there any other public comments on agenda items? Hearing none, approval of minutes, February 25th, 2025 regular meeting, March 13th, 2025 special meeting.
Can we do them as a block? If so, I move.
Yes.
Second.
Roll call.
Carla?
Yes.
Rayette?
Yes.
Rita?
Yes.
Carlene?
Yes.
Hillary?
Yes.
Brenda?
Yes.
Motion carries.
Thank you. Student report is in your packet. Next is the superintendent's report. Mike.
Madam President, members of the board, thank you very much. Nice to see everybody. I don't know if anybody notices, but I do always start my report with a quote that I appreciate. And this year, or this month, I went with my friend Ben Franklin. An investment in knowledge pays the best interest, and that's something I've been repeating over and over again to our legislators and to our borough assembly, and to anybody else who will listen, that in these tough financial times, there's no better investment we can make than in our schools. And that's a literal investment, not a figurative investment. As we're speaking, the House has, or previously the House has passed, the Alaska House has passed HB 69, which I've discussed previously in this in front of this group. It was modified from the initial one. So the bill that passed the House last week was included the $1,000 BSA increase, but did not include the 404 in the two subsequent years, and it did not include inflation proofing the BSA. But I will say that that bill moving forward to the Senate definitely is showing that our state legislature is getting serious about investing in the future of Alaska's schools and kids. So that was encouraging. Unfortunately, we did meet with the Commissioner Bishop last week, the superintendents did, and she indicated that in spite of the concessions that we made that were made for the governor's agenda in House Bill 69, it's unlikely that he's going to sign or approve that $1,000 increase. So we're hopeful that the legislator is behind an increase. We're just not sure what the governor's going to agree to at this point. My report's in the packet. A couple more things I want to point out. One is that we have narrowed down to a consensus on open court reading for our ELA adoption. I'll talk a little bit more about that later in the action items. I think there's no better illustration of health and wellness, the last section of my report always, than the regional tournament that we got to have in King Cove. It was both literal health and wellness, watching kids compete hard physically, but also just the health of a community was illustrated in how the great community of King Cove came together to prepare for and then celebrate. And it's shows how important it is to keep pushing to have events like that in our communities. It's really uplifting. And on that note, I wanted my gratitudes for this month really are toward the community of King Cove. I like to be specific, but really that whole community just showed the best side and really impressed other schools and officials in pulling off this great successful event. A couple of real specific thank yous I want to share, though. Couple individual community members, Joe Calver and Charles Mack, really stepped up. We had a little issue with one of our referees, and those two men at the last minute stepped up and did a great job reffing some really tough games, and were impartial and appreciated by everybody. We also had a near tragedy in King Cove recently when the compressor in the walk-in freezer went out. So right before this big event, and we have all these pallets of food coming in, we don't have a freezer at the school. So a lot of people came together to make that work. And two critical people were Mark and Kay Thompson at the AC store there, who really helped with logistics and also just storing a lot of the food for the school in the last month. And then Coach Ricky was off with the boys. And so while he was gone, Brittany and Samantha Yachmanoff really did a great job filling in our kitchen, both cooking for our kids and for all the other people at the event. So those were just a few illustrations of how people stepped up to make a great event. Rest is in the packet.
Savannah Yachmanoff, sir. Brittany and Savannah.
Oh, Savannah, sorry, I misspoke. Thank you. If there's any, the rest is in the packet. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to address them now.
Anybody have any questions? All right, thank you. Next is district correspondence. And first up is Sandpoint, Scotland.
Hello, everyone. So my report's in the packet as well, but just some things that have happened recently that we're excited about. We had three students in the district that got into Prince William Sound for next fall, two Sandpoint students and one King Cove student. So I just was really thankful for that. And the boys, I know, were super excited about it as well. NYO started in full swing, and I just love NYO, and Peyton's really good with the kids, and they love having her as a coach, and that's just been fun to be a part of or see going on. And then I want to express gratitude for Austin today. Austin does a lot and is always willing to help out. And I've been down a lot of staff lately, and today I was down six staff, and I didn't know who was going to teach social studies, and it was going to just end up being that they would be absorbed into other classes because I'm covering three of the six people that are out. And I asked Austin, knowing that he had King Cove testing, if it might be possible, and if not, no big deal. And he just jumped in and was just more than happy to cover it and make it happen. And that just took a huge load off of me. And he is always willing to help. And I just really appreciate his positive attitude. It really helps in the school environment, especially when things are stressful and crazy at the end of the school year when there's a lot going on. So thank you to Austin. And that's all I have, unless there's any questions.
Any questions? All right, thank you. Is Karen Ravenscroft on?
She's in Dutch Harbor.
Oh, okay. So her report's in our packet. Next is False Pass.
Hi, everyone. Reports in the packet. Couple key things here for False Pass School. You know, Mike spent a week here, so he gave me a lot of great feedback and input on things that are going well and areas that can be improved upon. So definitely using that information to try to plan for the next school year. You know, I'm happy with how some things have been, but there's definitely areas we can improve upon teaching the students here. So I think there's a lot of work behind the scenes happening with thinking about the schedule next year. You know, we're ordering a new elementary ELA curriculum, and just balancing between the elementary, middle school, and high school students. So that's a big item right now, is getting ready for the fall. Number two, for a PICTA grant, Mark Daniels and the other carpenter arrive, I believe, this Saturday, weather pending. So the project starts Monday. So that's going to be really exciting for our kids. You know, I think we traveled previously, but with having a bigger class this year, 13 students, our thought process was that travel would not be feasible, and that, you know, by having it locally, by using the grant here in Falls Pass, and all students will be able to participate. So we'll get a schedule made with them, and, you know, elementary kids can help with this. You know, middle school, high school kids probably can do more things. So we'll create a schedule where they're still doing their testing and getting their classwork done, but they'll have fun time to work on the canoe as well. So we'll take a lot of pictures on that. And Carlene had a great idea with that. On the last day, or the second last day before they leave, we'll have a picnic and just kind of celebrate building the canoe for the students, parents, and community. Like the other schools, we have parent-teacher conferences and report cards coming up. So looking forward to having those conversations with the parents and with the students. And yeah, just doing the best we can to support them in their learning. I just feel very thankful because the parents are extremely supportive and cooperative. Majority of my stress comes from athletic director work with all the travel and scheduling. But the parents have been extremely supportive and easy to work with. So looking forward to that. And this is kind of a small thing, but I just started shampooing the carpets here in Falls Pass, and it feels amazing. You would not believe how much dirt has come out of the carpets, because vacuuming can only do so much. So
it is a satisfying feeling, all that.
Okay, well, that's all I got. If anyone has any questions, but it's all in the packet.
All right, thank you. Next up, Kinko.
Hello. I do want to reiterate what Mr. Franklin said about the regional competition here going so well and so many people becoming involved. It's a great learning experience for me. It's very gratifying to work with such a great group of people in the building. And kind of to that end, I did want to acknowledge that we have just in all of these sort of staffing changes that we have, and in all of the things that are going to be kind of constructed new and differently here, I do want to acknowledge that our support staff is just outstanding, and they are the glue of this place. We have great, you know, the kids come to school, you know, to a building that is well maintained. Our maintenance people spent all day working on a blower, a heater that, you know, was having all kinds of issues. And there's always, you know, something, right? And kids come to a school that is well maintained. It's very clean. We have support staff. We have some that are very supportive, work with the kids, you know, at wherever they are. You know, in the form of, you know, our aides and, you know, library. We have a wonderful cook. Kids are eating nutritious meals. So, I mean, we just have a really great support staff. And so the classified staff, I really feel like should be given kudos for all of that. Because they were the ones that were really, you know, all hands on deck when a lot of the coordination efforts and the details of our day-to-day work during the tournament were going on, you know, before and after. State tournament went great. We took, you know, the team to state. We had a lot of sick boys, but they had a good time and they represented us really well. I think I acknowledged that in the report that I had. our new playground has arrived. And so, you know, Austin again, and I think Cheryl too, are going to be coming here next week to start the new quarter. And I know Austin's had a lot to do with getting our playground here. So we're trying to figure out now how it's going to be assembled this summer. So we'll be working on that. There are actually a lot of fun and interesting things that I think we're looking forward to now that we've kind of gotten over the hump of testing. You know, tomorrow we'll be finished, I think, pretty much. You know, we have trips coming up, we have activities coming up. There are kids who are applying. You know, we have the senior trip and close up, and kids applying to go to AMSEP in June. We have, you know, tomorrow there are a bunch of middle school students who are volunteering for the Elders Mardi Gras Tea downtown to help with that. We got a grant from the Alaska Arts Council to do a week-long theater, music, cultural heritage extravaganza the very last week of school, which I think will be great. The people who were involved with the STEAM group that went to Wasilla last fall are coming back and bringing some equipment with them. So during that week, we hope to have our math fair. We'll probably, possibly, maybe that week, do our literacy fair, maybe some kind of even science night that includes all of that equipment that's coming in with the visitors that'll be here from the Kinnick Tribes Bente STEAM organization, so that we can also provide those sort of enrichment activities for students during that time. So we have a lot going on, you know, busy calendar, trying to involve kids with as many different kinds of things as possible. And in the midst of that, also, you know, exploring our staffing options for next year and trying to, you know, think about how we're going to reconfigure our classes and our staff to best meet the instructional needs of our students. So thank you. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Were there any questions? Okay, thank you for all your reports. Next is the business manager's report on financials.
Thank you, Madam President, members of the board, Superintendent Franklin. My report is in your packet, and I do not have anything to add at this time.
Are there any questions about the financial report? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion to accept the current financial report as presented.
This is Brenda, make that motion.
Brenda, you want a second? I got Carla on the motion. Okay.
Second.
Thank you. Motion by Carla, second by Brenda. Roll call.
Hillary?
Yes.
Rita?
Yes.
Carlene?
Yes.
Amy?
Yes.
Brand?
Yes.
Carla?
Yes.
Brenda?
Yes.
Motion carries.
Okay, thank you. Department reports is next. Activities. Director Matt, you're up again.
Yeah. So, yeah, a lot of exciting things happening during February and March. We talked about state basketball, and I think the main thing I want to highlight, you know, I appreciate Ricky being a, you know, positive role model, and he's really of course, we want to win games. We want to win championships. But appreciate Ricky and the coaches that we're first and foremost about educating our student athletes. And, you know, we're disappointed. We lost a couple games. But first and foremost, we're trying to uplift and support our kids. So that's kind of our priority with the athletics. Ricky has consistently had great communication with me as an AD, so I I appreciate his work, and Karen provided great support for our basketball team at state. Glad there wasn't any terrible weather. We got him in on time, so that was great. Regionals, again, Mike and Karen talked about it, but King Cove staff and community just went above and beyond. Countless number of people just made it so much easier for me as an AD. Karen was a great host, and she even took me on the road. That was a beautiful drive, and I was just blown away by how beautiful King Cove was. So I really enjoyed that drive, seeing around town. It was so cool for me, you know, to be physically in the school, because obviously I'm here in Falls Pass, but, you know, the cultural activities, Lynette Mack, and I just thought it was the coolest thing at regionals, with the cultural dancing, being part of the school and seeing people in person was great. Fanny Dentesa, I got to see a practice with King Cove girls basketball, King Cove boys basketball, and Sandpoint girls basketball. So I really enjoyed seeing them practice. It wasn't like a formal thing or evaluating, nothing like that. I was just sitting in and just being present and a way for me to connect with the coaches. So yeah, and there was just so many supportive, helpful people with running regionals. You know, so this is my first time not coaching, and now that I'm, you know, in an AD role, and so it's a totally different perspective for me. You know, I'm not worried about coaching. I'm not worried about my team. You know, we're worried about the logistics, the travel. I really appreciate Mike and Karen really stepped up big time on Saturday morning. It was just kind of crazy with how many teams were flying out in a short span of time. So it was just nuts. You know, we have all these different teams. We had to monitor and track, and it all worked out well. Every team got home on time. So that was a big plus. But they really helped me a lot with the travel piece, because I, you know, we had two boys teams returning, and then we had five girls teams leaving. So that's a lot of flights to kind of manage, and updates from the airlines and all that kind of stuff. But it worked out well. All our teams were there on time, and all of our teams left on time. So we talked about regionals. NYO's going. Our students here in Falls Pass practice on a daily basis, helping Karen and Megan with their NYO orders for Etta and Peyton. So their apparel should be hopefully coming in soon. And then, yeah, we're Mike and I and the principals, we've been talking a lot about the handbook. So we're revising, we're editing the student activities handbook. And basically we want a concise document for the parents and students. And then the coaches will have a more detailed document. So we just want to make sure that we're really clear on the expectations and policies to support our coaches and communicate with the parents and supporting our student athletes. And then here in the new future, we're also going to be working on the student activities calendar for next year. So we'll be putting that together. And we definitely want to listen to the coaches, and we're going to do our best to create the best possible schedule, you know, knowing with the budget, and there'll be some challenges, but we're going to be as proactive as possible and flexible and creative to try to provide the best possible schedule. You know, like Sockeye tournament, three of our coaches indicated that they were very open to staying late a few days and getting more games in. So we're definitely going to look for solutions like that. But that's all I got AD wise. If anyone has any questions.
Are there any questions? Very none. I have a question real quick. When do you expect the, like, next year's sports schedule will be completed?
It's going to be created by the end of the school year. Mike and I are going to be working on that, and we'll create a draft, and of course Mike, Cheryl, and Sherilyn will have to look at the budget, but definitely we want it made by the end of the school year for sure.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Yep.